Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the Legendarium podcast, another Author's Shelf episode, one that I'm really excited for reasons that we'll talk about. The book that we're going to be discussing is Fire Lord by Park Godwin. And oh, there it is. And my guest today, returning guest, this is happening more and more often now, but seldom have I been as excited for a returning guest as I am today, because it's Daniel Ford, who you and I had a discussion last year that I thoroughly enjoyed. People should go check that out. But today it's Fire Lord. Yep. Daniel, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. We're recording this on Saturday morning for me. I think you're East Coast, so yeah, Saturday afternoon for you. And it's, is this work? Technically, yes. We're working on a Saturday. But if you have an hour to talk about Fire Lord, you take it and enjoy your Saturday, right?
Agreed. Yeah, absolutely.
So for those who don't remember, Daniel Ford, you're the author of the Paladin Trilogy, Ordination, Stillbright, and Crusade. People can check those out. But more recently, The Warden came out last year. The trade paperback is coming out on March 26th.
Yep.
And with an excellent Glenn Cook blurb that we were just talking about. So it's got the bona fides for everybody to sell them on it. But book two is actually coming out next month on April 23rd. It's called Necrobane, and you and I are going to talk more about that later in the episode.
Sure. Yep.
All right. So before we get to Fire Lord, I'll just remind everybody to go to thelegendarium.com, check out the links to Patreon, to Discord, the calendar of upcoming episodes, and especially past episodes that are all grouped by author or by subject. So if you enjoy these author's shelf episodes, for instance, you can go on the website and there's a page with all of the author's shelf episodes. So you can either listen to them on the page itself, or you can just use that to find what the episode numbers are. So you can check them out on your podcatcher. That's at thelegendarium.com. And also in the show notes, you'll find a link to Daniel's website so you can check out his projects as well. Now, Fire Lord.
Yeah.
This was something. This was something else. I was not prepared for how much I was going to enjoy reading this book, because as you noted, Park Godwin may be kind of a forgotten hero of this genre.
Yeah.
Forgotten by too many, not by everybody, apparently. Mm-hmm. Because when I tried to look for this book, there's no ebook version.
Nope.
There's no audiobook.
Yeah. It's out of print.
You can get used paperbacks online. And that's what I had to go for. It almost made it more worth it to have to kind of like hunt down a copy of it to read. Yeah. But anyway, let's get to all that. Let me ask you my standard first question. Daniel, why did you choose Fire Lord by Park Godwin?
Because I went searching for Park Godwin again last year, and I hadn't read Fire Lord before. I had read his Robin Hood series when it came out in the 90s, which is also excellent historical fantasy. But then I was like, wait a minute, he wrote an Arthurian series. I didn't even know Fire Lord was Arthurian. And so every so often my wife and I do an order on ABE books where we grab some used books or some out of print books, and we happen to grab one, and I think I read it in a day and a half, and then I read it again and became kind of obsessed with it, because there are so many different versions of Arthur, and this book packs more of them into one fairly compact novel than I would have believed possible. If you want Arthur, the Roman warlord, like Bernard Cornwell did, it's here. Mm. If you want the Celtic Arthur, it's here. If you want Arthur, like the Grail Quest and the Knights of the Round Table and the Brotherhood, that's here. Kind of the only version of Arthur that isn't is the fully like anachronistic Excalibur, like full 14th century reticulated, like 15th century reticulated plate armor, knights on horseback. But like they're still knights on horseback in advanced armor, even if they don't use the term knight, So it is kind of there, even though they're using, like Roman equipment. And it's also, Godwin is just writes beautiful, beautiful prose. There are sentences and paragraphs in his books that just burned themselves into my brain the first time I read them. There are several passages like that in Fire Lord.
I've written down a couple of lines that jumped out to me at certain points in the book, and there are dozens more that I didn't write down. Yeah. But I wanted to have some examples because I fully agree. His prose is awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. So as you say, this is a distillation of all of those, or yeah. I don't know if that's the right word, but it's kind of an amalgam of all of these different versions of Arthur. Mm-hmm. And it's told, the thing that jumped out to me was the style in which he tells it, it being extremely accessible. It's not always totally modern. You know, some of the characters are throwing out the thous and these, and they're dropping prepositions, and they're dropping pronouns. And so it's not that his characters talk in a modern vernacular, but they talk in a way that's more accessible than some of the versions of Arthur that you might read.
He definitely doesn't do any sort of like, you know, trying to do like fake Geoffrey of Monmouth or like fake Malory, you know, stilted medieval dialogue. They talk in a way that's very, very accessible, but I think it's just down to, he's just so good at it. The prose style is so good that even when they're not necessarily using modern syntax or even modern vocabulary, but you still understand everything they're saying. And that is truly an achievement. And I think it's like the Pridden characters, who are like the Celtic characters, they talk in a very different syntax, that's sort of signifying that they're speaking a different language, and they have different priorities in their language than the sort of Roman noble characters that are Arthur and Guinevere. That they see the world in a different way, and that is expressed through how they talk, which is another genius thing that he does.
Absolutely. It's we might as well go to page one of the book. So to set it up for those who haven't read it, you should read it, but I think you'll be able to follow along with our discussion, even if you haven't. If you go to just page one of the book, it's Arthur on his deathbed. Mm-hmm. And Arthur is going, he's going to tell the story of his life and dictate it so that his assistant can write it down. Right. But the whole book starts with, "Damn it, I haven't time to lie here." Yeah. And then he goes on. It's an immediately emotionally resonant. Mm-hmm. And if you know anything about the Arthur story, and if in that first page it becomes clear that he's on his deathbed,
emotion.
No, you're good. You're good. The emotion bleeds through immediately once you get the context. And so he says, "Damn it, I haven't time to lie here." And you're like, "You're dying. What do you mean? Yeah. What do you need to go do?"
There's always more for a king to do, right? I think that's the next line. But also, that's like a central tension of the book with Arthur, is that this Arthur wants like home and family and that like grounding, and he never ever gets it. And because the demands of being Arthur, the demands of living up to it, like, is it prophetic? Was Merlin his own imagination? Is it actually a vision? Because I don't think anybody else in this book ever interacts with the Merlin character. I think like just Arthur does.
But
he has this pull of like, I can save this country, like I can hold Roman Britain together and unify it, and nobody else can. And so he never gets that time of respite, of rest. And of course, if you know the Arthurian myth, you know that like his, you know, relationship with Guinevere is not exactly perfect. Lancelot is in this book. Lancelot Guinevere thing happens, but not the usual Lancelot, not the usual Arthur Guinevere like resolution either. And that's one of my favorite things in the books, is he's like, I'm just going to rewrite that because I don't like how that ends in most versions. So I'm just going to make Arthur and Guinevere really respect one another and continue to like play their roles and have like, if not a romantic relationship, they're at least friendly before the end of the book.
And he brings the character that we often call Morgan Le Fay.
Yeah.
He calls her Morgana in this book and brings her to the fore and makes her relationship with Arthur really resonant.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful story.
Not his sister.
to be clear.
She is his sister in many versions, but not this one. Not always. She isn't always his sister, but in some versions she is. In this one, she's not. And yeah, they have like that. She is the only one who offers him that sort of home family sanctuary that he longs for. But if he's going to embrace that, then like everything else is going to fall apart around him. Right. Like Morgana's the life he cannot let himself have, whether that's because of ambition or destiny. It's kind of up to you.
And it creates, watch me jump, okay, from the very first page of the book to the very last page of the book, where it's, we know the story of Arthur, you know, he has his son, Mordred, or Modred, I guess.
Modred is like the original name, I think.
Right. And, you know, the son kills the father and the father kills the son, and it's all very Greek tragedy, right? But in order to give you that happy ending, when Arthur dies, he essentially leaves his body and looks down on it, and then Morgana comes and welcomes him into her embrace, and they go kind of right off into the spiritual sunset. It's the way that he writes it is just gorgeous.
It is. Yeah, it's beautiful.
I'm debating whether I should read it.
Arthur. There's no spoilers in Arthurian myth at this point. The timer has run out. The story's 1,000 years old. Get with the program.
Well, that's true up to a point. But I might push back on that a little bit because, as we know, and as we've alluded to, every version of Arthur is different.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, that's Lancelot true. was that the 14th century French edition?
I think maybe 12th. It was pretty early edition, but like Lancelot's kind of like the first fan fiction that became canon.
Right.
Is what I call it.
Yeah, exactly. So you have this kind of British Isles myth, and the earliest version that we have of Arthur is already pretty mythological. He's already a larger than life character. So we know he existed, but even the early accounts of him that we have are like, oh no, this guy was something else. He was something special. And then the French come along and they're like, oh, and there's this guy, Lancelot.
Crétin de Troyes is like, you know what the story needs? It needs the perfect knight and he's French.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we have all these different versions. And now we have Fire Lord, Park Godwin's version. And you can say you can't spoil the Arthur story. And to some extent, that's true. But on the other hand, because every version is different, there is something to the idea of go experience this version fresh.
Yeah, I would agree.
Right?
Yeah, definitely there's something to that because this version, like I said at the beginning, is so many versions tied together that I think experiencing it, There is something to be said for experiencing it fresh and not being spoiled. You know Arthur's going to die. That's how his story always ends.
Right.
But yeah, maybe we don't read the last page for people. But
I kind of spoiled it already. But you know what? If I were selling this book to somebody, it wouldn't be the events per se. Because as you know, you might have a different version in your head, but you pretty much know the events.
Sure.
It's how he writes them. It's how he brings the characters to life. And we should probably talk about that more. How his style, his actual prose style and his dialogue style brings characters to life in a way that not many other authors that I've read are able to pull off. Do you have a favorite character to read in this book?
I really like Percival in this book, or Peredur. He's given his Welsh name, Peredur. Right. But one of the things that he does that he lets one character talk about another character, like what are their thoughts and feelings about that other character. And the way I've sold this book to people is I'll be like, these characters feel like really these mythical names feel like real people, but they're real people in whom you can see the myths being born.
Mm.
That makes sense.
I like that.
You can see why these characters would become mythical based on who they are and what they do. I'm thinking of after Geraint dies, the letter that informs Arthur that Geraint died. I wish I should have marked the page, but it's where it describes Geraint as God's eager assassin with, I wish I could, I should have marked pages, but I didn't think about it. but yeah, with neither something, cause the Geraint in here is like, he's not very smart. He's a really good warrior. And he just kind of doesn't know better. Than to be a warrior. That's it. That's all he is. I can't remember. Wait a minute.
Well, while you're looking that up,
I found it.
Oh, you did. Okay. Yeah. Go for it.
So he gets Peridor's letter, talking about Geraint. He says, "I curse my ignoble mind, even as it compels me to look at dear Jerry Falk," which was like a diminutive term of affection they use. They shorten somebody's name and add F-A-C-H. "Dear Jerry Falk, without tears, God's eager assassin with neither the imagination to fear nor the intellect to doubt. We are shaped as the Lord needs, I suppose. Some men light and epic. Geraint was for a moment. Rest him gentle." Ugh. The prose is so good. And it's Peridor, who's the super religious character in this book, super devout Christian, looking at Geraint in an honest way and saying, like, here are the things that made him great and here are the things that made him terrible. And I'm accepting him as a whole person in memorializing his death. And it's so beautiful to me and so good.
And now first of all, yes, heart agree. Yeah. And now I have to go to Peridor as an old man.
Yes.
And so this is toward the end of the book.
Peridor's death is one of my favorite parts of this book. Yeah, it's tough sledding.
because he writes these characters so well that you get attached, mm-hmm. in a way that authors try really hard to get you attached to their characters. Mm-hmm. And Park Godwin seems to do it kind of, I'm sure it's not effortless, but it feels effortless as you're reading it. So we're on Peridor's deathbed, basically. And he says, Peridor held out his white hand. "You'll be going soon, in a day or so." His fingers spidered over mine, the grip of an infant. Oh my gosh. And I don't even care what he says after that. Like that line, his fingers spidered over mine, the grip of an infant, talking about this man that he loves on his deathbed, that's some good writing. And it goes to, actually, if I can have a digression here, one of my obsessions is prose styling, mm-hmm. and the intersection of prose versus poetry or verse.
Okay.
And how they interplay and interact and what the differences are and the unappreciated beauty of prose.
Okay.
And this line, "his fingers spidered over mine, the grip of an infant," is so poetic. It's beautifully written. It's a great analogy. Mm-hmm. Two analogies really in one sentence, or two visualizations in one sentence. And so it's poetically beautiful, but you don't actually grasp the full weight of it without the prosaic context of everything that came before, mm-hmm. and the stuff that's about to come right after.
Yeah.
That's one of the beauties of prose, is that it takes its time to work its magic on you.
It does.
Whereas poetry is more, you know, quick fire.
Sure.
With its emotional resonance. But this is an excellent marriage of the two, where you have a really well constructed, well written line that is made much, much more beautiful when you understand everything around it.
Yeah. And this is, of course, In the Arthur myth, this is right at the end of the Grail quest, right? Peridor found the Grail, but it's not like the Holy Grail quest with the Fisher King, and they don't, you know, go into a castle and see the Grail like lit above it. It's literally, he's been like digging in the mud, and it's like an archaeological dig, and he finds something that might well be the Grail. And at the very least, they're going to pretend it's the Grail, because that will be a potent way to try and keep the kingdom united as things are heading towards civil war, you know, and because they make Peridor Percival the really religious Christian character, like it's so powerful a thing for him to have done that in the hopes. Like his next line is, "I would see you at peace, but for the absurd things." I love you all. I'd see you at peace, but for the absurd things we have to do. It's like he kind of knows his role in this might not be purely religious, but he's going to have that faith anyway. And he is trying to do his best to bring Arthur and Guinevere back together, at least in a, like, not necessarily in a romantic sense, but in a political sense. So you have this religious character whose faith is so strong, and he's giving his life for the religious cause the way Peridot does in the legend of the Grail, but also for the political cause, but also because he does love these two people. And right. It's tying all three of those things together so beautifully. And honestly, I think possibly my favorite passage in the entire book is Arthur reflecting on Peridot's death on like the facing page. I don't even know if I could read it aloud because it makes me too emotional, but he says he died in his sleep the night after I left. The Bishop of Caerleon said the mass himself, and the requiem was sung by a choir of several dozen monks. Masses were ordered for each anniversary of Peridot's death. The prince lay in state 2 full days. I think more of the faithful knelt at his bier than will ever weep over mine. Why not? He touched an enduring need in their hearts. They saw him rise like a spirit bird, molting morality, ranks of angels guiding him to paradise, Dona Eis Requiem, armies of welcoming seraphim, ranked saints eager to make him one of them, his head suffused in holy light. Peridot would have thought it all a bit thick because his faith is so simple and pure and direct, and Arthur knows that about him. But he's also like recognizing people are going to miss this guy more than they're going to miss me because of what they're projecting on him. It's so, so good. I knew him. His faith might have sent him down the well, but a keen critical mind led him there, and he always hated crowds. Yeah.
That's how I know I like him, because I'm with him on that.
As for veneration on earth or apotheosis in heaven, he would be distracted by the noise and embarrassed by the adulation.
We need Todd on this episode because he's the crier on the Legendarium, and we could use some real tears for this.
I haven't cried since I was 11 years old, I always say, but it got dusty in the room when I was reading that.
Is that true?
It's true-ish. I say that to my students. I haven't cried since I was 11 years old. Nice. It keeps them afraid.
I went 11 years without like fully crying. You know, it would get dusty in the room, as you say. And then my cat died.
Oh.
This is like 8-9 months ago. And I'll tell you what, the floodgates were opened after that. Now these books, like, you know, they really get to me.
Yeah. So. If I can briefly talk about a related Arthurian story, my cat who I'd had for 19 years died in August of last year. Yeah. So just about coming up on 7 months. And I was rereading the Fionnuala tapestry. And the stuff with the dog, Caval, really struck home a couple times while I was reading that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's there's a whole website. I think it's called Does the Dog Die? And it goes through mostly movies. I think it started with movies, but maybe they do books as well. Well, they tell you if the dog dies, so that people who don't want to have to deal with that don't go see the movie.
Yeah. Well, it's not even Caval doesn't die in those books. It's Arthur keeps expecting to die because he's Arthur and he knows he's Arthur. And that series is like the mythic Arthur, like the Campbellian Arthur. And he is brought back to fight in like war after war after war as part of this punishment for things he did in life and like various fantasy worlds, but he thinks he's going to die and he's going to be parted from Caval. And he gives this speech that starts with, I don't remember the whole thing, but it starts with the words, farewell, my gallant joy. And it is such a beautiful part of that book.
Yeah. Look at us going on about pets. Jeez.
Yeah.
You're going to get me going here pretty soon. Jeez.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on maybe to something else.
Yeah. Let's talk about Fire Lord.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about Fire Lord. I've got a digression for you.
Sure.
But we'll bring it back. This will relate, I swear. When I was in college, I studied English linguistics.
Okay.
And one of the most fun units that we had, lasted a week or two maybe, is we talked about, in this overview of the history of American English, we talked about, I think they call it African-American Vernacular English. Okay. At some point, I don't know if it's still the official term, but in the 70s, the invented term was Ebonics.
Yeah.
Well, okay. All right. Good. So it started out, it was called Ebonics, right? And Black English, African-American Vernacular English, whatever you want to call it. There was a translation of the Bible in Ebonics, and it was in the early 90s. It was like 92, 93, something like that. And it took selected passages from the Bible and translated it into what at the time was called Ebonics. And there was this fantastic debate, at least I thought it was really interesting, about whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. Is this treating the Bible with the respect it deserves, or is it making it accessible to people who prefer this vernacular style, whatever? I'm curious, because that's what I kept thinking of it as I was reading through this book, where these characters are so accessible to a modern reader, despite what the actual language might sometimes be. They feel real, they talk real, they think real.
Mm-hmm.
Do you enjoy, or do you tend to recoil from these mythological stories being translated into more modern language? So when you're reading Arthur, did it take you any time? Or when you were reading the Robin Hood series, the Park Godwin series, which I haven't read. This is my first exposure to Park Godwin. But he brings these ancient myths forward into a modern aesthetic, in the hopes, I assume, of making it accessible to readers. Do you prefer that, or do you prefer reading stories like this in a more ancient style?
Well, either one is a constructed dialect, right? Nobody's writing Arthur stories in the original language because we don't know what it was. Right? We don't know how they talked and they sounded. I think if you're writing now in 2024, you probably want to meet your audience where they are and where they live and be able to write in a way that they understand. I definitely try to write accessible characters when I'm writing. And when I'm reading, I might take the historicist out here, but I want to read a book in the style in which it was written and think about it in the context it was which it was written. So you're writing about mythological characters in 2024. I want to read a translation that I want to read a version that I understand. And if I'm reading the work in translation, if I'm going to read Dante, I want to read a translation into something that was poetic, but contemporary English, like Robert Pinsky's translation or W.S. Merwin's translation. I feel the same way with this. I don't want to, I think if in the 2020s, if you're trying to write in a stilted medieval style, unless you're an actual medieval historian or medieval linguist, you're going to have a really hard time making that work. Right. And really confusing. At the same time, as a teacher of English, I hate it when people go get those translations of Shakespeare, because Shakespeare's writing in modern English and you can understand it with a little bit of work, right? Shakespeare helped create modern English in a lot of ways. And so, yes, I prefer it being accessible, but I don't think everything needs to be flattened into however we're talking now, because however we're talking now is not how we're going to be talking in 20 or 30 years. Does that make sense? Or was that a comment?
Right. So accessible yet timeless
if you're as good as Park Godwin, then accessible but timeless is doable.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. So many writers they're not just not scholars of, say, Middle English, Old English for that matter, you know, or even early modern English, that there are plenty of writers out there who don't even have a grasp on how thee and thou work.
Yeah.
You know, like how that kind of informal register worked.
Right. Because that's the informal, and people often use it to sound more formal.
And exactly.
It's totally incorrect.
So if you, but if you do come across somebody who has that expertise, they could probably do a pretty good job of making it accessible and understandable to you. And which I would put Park Godwin in that camp. Obviously, I'm a Tolkien guy, as everybody listening knows. And so he's going to be my gold standard of somebody who knew language better than anybody else in the room, and he knew it.
Yeah. I'm also a Tolkien guy. So, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you can see, but the horn, there's the Horn of Gondor on the hanging on.
Right over your shoulder. That's perfect. Yeah. So he could get away with archaisms in especially the latter half of the Lord of the Rings that no other author would get away with, because he actually understood how it was supposed to sound and how to bring it into a modern register. Mm-hmm. And Park Godwin fits that beautifully, where I've been talking about this with George Martin. We did a Game of Thrones recently, and one of his strengths is his analogies and his similes that are really beautiful and piercing and somewhat rare. Where you're reading a Game of Thrones and you'll come across, you know, Bran climbing the tower. This is the beginning of the book. Don't worry, I'm not spoiling anything. Bran climbing the tower, and he loved the air that was sweet like a summer peach.
Yeah.
And that you have this line that just strikes you.
Yeah.
And then you're, I want the next one. And you're gonna be waiting 15, 20 pages for another really good analogy like that. Park Godwin, in a similar vein, he has characters and lines of dialogue or even description that are piercing like that, but he doesn't overwhelm you with it page after page after page.
Yeah.
For the most part, it reads and flows and doesn't distract your attention with its beauty. And then he'll hit you with something that grabs you. What do you think?
No, I absolutely agree. He will draw it out and draw it out and draw it out. And then he's like, and now in a moment of heightened emotion, I'm going to punch you right in the face with beautiful prose.
Yes.
100%. He does that. He does that in the Robin Hood series too. Like, absolutely does
you've,
that in Robin
you've
Hood
got too. Me pretty sold. I think I'm going to go pick up some Robin Hood books.
Sherwood is a great Robin Hood book, and it sets... So he embraces anachronism. He sets Robin Hood during the Norman conquest. Like, it is 1066. And Robin is the son of an Anglo-Saxon thane. But the brilliant thing he does is he makes the Sheriff of Nottingham a real guy. He makes him a character named Ralph Fitzgerald, who is part of the book is in his head, part of it's in Robin's head. And neither of them are bad people. But they both see the world so incredibly differently because they come from an incredibly different value system that there's almost no way that they're not going to become enemies. And it is brilliantly done, making the Sheriff of Nottingham, by his own morality, by the system he's raised in, he is a good man doing the right thing. For Robin, in the system he was raised in, he is a good man doing the right thing.
Ooh, I feel like there's a lesson for modern audiences in there somewhere if we dig really far, right? Mm. That's fabulous. Yeah, no, I'll be picking that up. The last thing I want to bring up, and I'll turn the floor to you before we stop talking about Fire Lord, but I also want to talk about the humor in this book, because we've been talking a lot about, you know, these wonderful characters and the beautiful poetic lines and the deathbed scenes and all these things. It's a funny book. There are real moments of I almost want to say it's hilarious in some points. So the first time we meet Merlin, who, as you say, may or may not be real.
Right.
I'm reminded of that classic Dumbledore line, you know, when Harry says, "Is this real or is it in my head?" And Dumbledore says, "Of course it's in your head, but why does that make it any less real?" Love that line. So Merlin is talking to Arthur, and he's introducing himself. He says, "Yeah, Merlin. Merlin will do for a name. That midge that deals with the might of Arthur." And that's MITE.
Yeah.
The midge that deals with the might of Arthur. And I just I guffawed. I was like, that is a deft line right there. And it's one of those times when I was really grateful that you picked a slightly obscure book that's not on Audible. And it's not, I wasn't getting an ebook or whatever where I had to see that line. You've got to see a line like that to really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, again, peppered throughout. It's not a comedy, but there are real moments of levity and comedy in this book.
I think the part I howled at the most is the last time that Arthur and Guinevere talk in this book, before he's riding off to what's going to be the Battle of Camlann. And, and at this point they've made peace with each other, which is kind of the big twist that he pulls. Like, Arthur does not imprison her, does not try to have her killed. And I think he leaves her as regent when he leaves, right? Like, he appoints her regent of the kingdom or something.
That's not right. I saw First Knight in the 90s. That's not how it happened.
Yeah. How can they not make a good Arthurian movie? It drives me crazy. But anyway, I wouldn't normally use the word, but he calls Guinevere the B word. I don't know if I can say that on this podcast.
Well, we'll leave it implied, yeah. I guess.
He says that, she says, "The best one in Britain, and God wouldn't have wasted a good girl on you, Pendragon." And I love that. That cracks me up every time I think about it.
Agreed.
Because at that point, she calls him a peasant and he calls her that. And it's not an insult. They're like, but they're insults in the way you might insult your friends or the people that you know really well, that you've known for 20 years, that you've grown up with. The best one in Britain.
It's the whole, yeah. I'm allowed to insult my siblings. Yes. You're not.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
That's how close they are.
Yeah. But God wouldn't have wasted a good girl on you, Pendragon. Oh, that line kills me every time. I love it.
And of course, then we have Morgana in the mix, right?
Yeah.
And so that's Arthur's true love, you might say.
Yeah.
And that actually brings in, so that line recalls to mind another note that I had, which was about the interplay of Christianity and paganism in the book. It's one of the things I love dealing with in books. So Beowulf would be a great example of this, where part of the fun of not just reading Beowulf, but digging into Beowulf and the story behind it, part of the fun of that is trying to figure out where the kind of Christian monks inserted their own asides to make it more palatable to a Christian audience, not get their heads chopped off, and what was originally pagan and all that stuff. There's a lot of that interplay in this book as well.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And Arthur kind of has a foot in both worlds, which kind of can satisfy the Arthur as like the Christian, Arthur as the Roman, Arthur as the Celt, right? He embodies all of those things in this book because of the time he winds up spending with the Pridden is his name for the Celtic people or the Picts.
The Welsh Celts,
yeah. Although he has them north of Hadrian's Wall, so that would technically make them like Scots Picts, right?
Yeah, that's true. I guess in my brain, Pridden being...
Yeah, Pridden is similar. Prydain is Wales, right?
Is the name of Wales. Yeah, yeah.
The Chronicles of Prydain by Lloyd Alexander, like foundational fantasy stuff. So yeah, he's definitely being anachronistic by calling them that. And they're Picts, but they're also Welsh Celts. And like the time Arthur spends with them is why he's called Fire Lord and why he's called Summer King. Right. Arthur firmly has feet in both worlds in this book, which again is, I don't know how he did it. I don't know how he did it in a book that is not quite 400 pages long. He puts all these versions of Arthur in it. I would think if you tried to do this, in a series now, it would be like 600 page books or something if you try to cover this much.
Yeah. No. And not nearly as deftly done.
No.
As a consequence. Right. Yeah. So I've steamrolled a bunch of this conversation, but I wanted to ask you, what any bullet points, any things you wanted to bring up, things you love about this book, ways you sell it?
I mean, I think, like I said, the way I sell it to people is you, the characters feel human, but you can see the myth rising up out of the human in them, right? Arthur feels very human and he has foibles and he has quirks, but like you see how he becomes Arthur the myth. You see this with Peridot, you see it with Guinevere. I think Lancelot maybe gets a little bit of short shrift in this book. He doesn't get a lot of time on stage. I love what he does with Tristan and Isolde in this book. I love what he does with Geraint. I love what he does with the Orkneys. I actually think one day I really want to write an Arthurian book one day, but I think it would be like an Orkneys book. I think it would be about Gawain more than it would be about anybody else.
Oh.
But that's a long term. I got so many other things I got to write first. yeah, it's really, for me, it's the characters. It's the way the characters are grounded and human, but also mythic. And the fact that it encompasses so many different visions of Arthur in one book.
Yeah.
That's what I love about it.
If I had to sell this book in some way, I would say, look, you know, at least in broad strokes, you know the story of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table and all that stuff. There are going to be a lot of deathbed scenes scenes, right? And I don't know that I have seen an author consistently nail character deaths as thoroughly as Park Godwin
100%.
Every death that you get is emotional and it's earned.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't even talked about the death of Modred yet.
Yeah.
At the end of the Battle of Camlann, mm-hmm. We've read enough passages and whatnot. People can go read the book.
Yeah.
So I'll leave it, but I'll just say, the death of Modred at the Battle of Camlann is so perfectly written that I'm left despairing of ever being able to write a book, let alone a book this good.
Yeah,
no, just by reading something like that.
I agree, and I've written a bunch of books, and I read this, and I think, like, why do I bother? Why am I trying?
So you know, Drew McCaffrey from the Inking Out Loud podcast got me to pick up the Acts of Cain series by Matthew Stover. So we've been going through that, and he is on a single-minded mission to revive that series specifically, but also just the name of Stover generally in fantasy fans, as like, no, this is somebody that we should be talking about the way that we talk about Martin or, you know, the Sanderson or whoever. We should be talking about the name Stover. I'll give it another book or two before I fully get there, but just based on Fire Lord, I'm going to say, look, we should, Park Godwin should be a household name, at least among nerds like us.
I totally agree. He did win a World Fantasy Award very early in his career, for a short story. And he was a guest at World Fantasy Con in like 2011, which was the year before he passed away. So he wasn't totally unrecognized in his time, but like his two big series for me, Fire Lord, the Robin Hood and the Arthurian series, they're out of print. And the Fire Lord came out in the 80s. The Robin Hood books were like the mid 90s, and they just seemed to kind of like, they just didn't seem to make a big impact. In the literature and in the culture. And I think that I would say Park Godwin as prose stylist and Arthurian interpreter, I would kind of put him in the same category as like Guy Gabriel Kay, which I feel like incredibly high praise, because Guy Gabriel Kay is a wonderful writer, beautiful prose stylist, incredible. And I feel like Park Godwin belongs in that conversation. I really, really do.
And I agree.
They've never
go on.
When I mention him, they've never heard of him. I have gotten some friends to start reading Sherwood and Fire Lord. And if I can lead like even a little bit of a revival of Park Godwin, I would love to be able to do that.
I'm with you. So I'm going to I'm going to operate on the assumption that most people listening to this were not familiar with Park Godwin. Mm-hmm. Some of you may have been, and I hope this was a fun and rewarding discussion for you, but for those who haven't read him, do so. It's not historical fiction. It's historical fantasy,
yeah,
right? 100%. It's an interesting blending of genres, and you're going to like it.
Yeah.
Full stop. Yeah. You're going to like it. If you're a regular listener to this show, then I have some idea of what you like, yeah. And you're going to like this book.
If you like
Fire Lord,
yeah. If you like Arthurian stuff, if you like Robin Hood, you need to read these books. You owe it to yourself to read these books. Yeah.
End of story. All right, Daniel, thank you for choosing this book. Like I said, it was a little tougher to track down a copy of it than it normally is for these author shelf episodes, but 100% worth it.
Great.
But we should probably talk about your stuff. You know, I want to actually bring in something from your bio.
Okay.
Because before we talk about your books, I have a burning question on my mind. As somebody who lived in France for a couple of years, you say in your detailed bio that you teach English and cheese appreciation. Okay.
I haven't actually taught cheese appreciation for a few years, but I did. I did teach it for a while.
What is that about?
So at the high school I teach at, we have these, the last period of the day are like club periods where, and it's a fun thing. So I do an RPG club now, and I do a walking club where we just go outside and walk for an hour. But for a few years I did an introduction to cheese appreciation. And I did collect a little money from the kids to fund it because it was expensive. And at this point it's just too expensive for me to do and I would have to do it for like five students and it's not worth it. But where I would go through here, I think cheese is like proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy the way Benjamin Franklin said about beer. And so I would do like a introduction to, you know, English cheese, introduction to French cheese, Italian cheese, German cheese. Like I made high school students eat Limburger. They weren't happy about it,
nice.
But I made them do it. The rule was if you joined, you had to try every cheese I presented. If you didn't like it, you didn't have to eat more of it, but you had to try it even if you were disinclined. Yeah, yeah. And so that was a lot of fun. Fabulous. I would go and I would give them like fact sheets on the origins of the cheese and why it has a protected appellation and where it's made and how and all that kind of stuff. It was a lot of fun.
Nice.
Yeah.
I love that. There's a play written by Mark Twain that wasn't published until actually quite recently in the last generation or so called Is He Dead? And the characters have to, there's a casket and they need to trick other characters into believing that there's a dead body in this casket. So they put Limburger in it so that if anybody opens the casket, they'll, there's definitely somebody dead in there. here's a gross cheese story for you. I honestly don't even remember what the variety was, but I was a young man living in France and this family invited us over for dinner and we're eating dinner and the woman brings out this plate of cheese and there's one, it's a really nice mild buttery yellow, but with this line of mold going through the middle.
Uh-huh.
And she goes, this is my favorite cheese. You got to try it. I'm like, I don't know. Blue cheese, that's a heavy lift. But I took a bite and forgive me, listener, for this description, but it's the only one I've ever been able to come up with. It was as though somebody had crystallized farts and put it in the middle of this block of cheese so that when I bit down on it, it just exploded in my mouth and filled the whole thing up.
Yeah.
I've never experienced anything like it.
The French make some really, really funky cheeses that we don't really import to this country very much. I would love to try some of them because I love funky blue cheeses. But I've even read some examples by some discussion by, you know, cheese experts and people who make their living, you know, making or promoting cheese, talking about some varieties of really small batch French blue cheeses are like really hard to eat if you didn't grow up with them.
Well, now I know what the title of this episode is going to be. It's going to be something about King Arthur and stinky cheese, okay, or whatever. But we should move on.
Sure.
Your new book. Well, I should remind people that The Warden, which came out last year, is now coming out in trade paperback.
Brand new
on
cover.
March 26th. Yep. Yeah, and it looks great.
Yeah.
And then book two is coming out next month on April 23rd, yes. Necrobane. Mm-hmm. Why don't you give us a quick rundown on this world, the story. Give us the elevator pitch.
So it's a book about supporting your local necromancer. Eilish Talenti graduates from magical college. She studies three schools of magic, but she's primarily a necromancer. And she becomes a warden, which is sort of like a justice of the peace or a magistrate. And she is a city girl. She's rich. She's a noble. She's a count's daughter. She has loads of money, loads of privilege. She gets sent to a sheep herding village 800 miles away from the nearest city. and she thinks it's some sort of political revenge or that, you know, somebody didn't like her. And when she's there, mysteries start to happen. And she realizes there might be reasons that she's there. And in the very end of book one, which kind of ends on a cliffhanger, which a lot of people are not happy about, she sort of maybe accidentally loosed a bunch of undead into the wilderness, which this wilderness now belongs to like roving orc bands, who are kind of like if orcs were Vikings. And if they come in contact with any of these undead that she loosed, it's gonna reignite a war that just ended like before she started college. And so Necrobane is about her sort of cleaning up her own mistakes and learning and growing from it.
All right. Well, yeah, excellent elevator pitch. So go check it out. The Warden and Necrobane. I know that a bunch of people read the Paladin trilogy. So if you liked that, definitely check these out. But, you know, and if you didn't read that one, get both.
Right? Yeah, please do.
The standard joke for authors is, hey, buy my book, buy it twice. You only have to read it once, but buy it twice.
Honestly, you don't even have to read it. If you just buy it, that's fine.
Just buy it. Give it to your friends.
Yeah.
No, that's fabulous. Daniel, thank you so much. And again, thank you for choosing Fire Lord.
Thanks for having me.
It's a becoming a somewhat common thing, but I don't know how often I mean it this thoroughly. Thank you for choosing Fire Lord. What a book. Yeah. And I hope lots of people pick it up from having listened to this discussion.
Yeah, me too. I really hope that I hope that Park Godwin becomes the household name he has always deserved to be.
Yeah, there you go. All right, everybody, don't forget to check the episode description for links both to our stuff and to Daniel's stuff. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you all next time.